like cold welds and stuff, or just like epoxy or something. You think that would work? Back to you.
Yaesu, Kenwood, Nikon have the original batteries with the tabs and 2EF.
Fantastic. How difficult is it to get them? For instance, if you've got a Kenwood battery, a Kenwood handy-talkie, ICOM is very good at supplying parts. Kenwood is kind of hard to get parts from. Do you think there's a likely ICOM equivalent to the Kenwood battery? Back to you, Rich.
Yeah, there probably is, Dick. In fact, I've got a battery sitting downstairs right now. You know who's got them is Al from Land Air Communications, K60PZ. I got a Kenwood battery from him for $7 with the tabs.
That's the right way to do it, though, Steve. Get the real tabs. If you had to roughen up the case and try to stick it with epoxy that's conductive, it's a possible approach, but the case itself is made out of such a high-grade stainless steel-like substance. I think the chances of you roughening the case enough to get a good bond with the epoxy that doesn't break away, I'm not convinced that that's going to be reliable because, let's face it, a handy talkie, at least the handy talkies I own, man, they earn their keep. Every handy talkie I own has at some time been put on the top of my car and I make the mistake of driving away and I hear clunk, clunk, boom, and I know it hit the ground. One of my handy talkies was dropped from the 80-foot level of A Tower onto asphalt. Another one was dropped from the 100-foot level onto my lawn. And both of them got beat up something fierce. I am using both of those IC2ADs today. Just bent them all back together again, so to speak, and almost restored them to their original condition. And boy, can those things take it. So handy talkies are going to be beat up. I would not trust a solder joint on that lithium cell. So I would try very hard to get the real battery with the tabs on it, even if it's not exactly the right battery. You're looking for a battery that will fit into the space that has approximately the same ampere hours. And if the one you get is a little bit bigger, a little bit smaller, a little bit fatter, a little bit thinner, but it has approximately the same ampere hours and can be squeezed in that case without creating any auxiliary short circuits, go for it. I mean, there are people who think you got to put in the exact battery. I run into this problem every time I go to Sears Roebuck and I want to buy a battery for my automobile. And I tell them, in the old days, I would tell them what model car I've got, and they look it up on a chart, and they say, you use battery number so-and-so, and I go over to that battery and put it in my car, and it only fills up two-thirds of the space that the old battery filled up. That bothers me. What I do is I make a careful measurement of the battery case of my car. I go and get the most rugged thing they've got. Maybe it's one intended for Land Rover service. Super heavy duty, but it's got the right dimensions. And I pick up that battery and I carry it to the guy at the counter and I say, I want to buy this battery. And he says, what kind of a car have you got? And I say, I'm not going to tell you. You're going to sell me this battery. And eventually, they realize how serious I am. They sell me that battery. I put it in the car and I have no problem for the next 6 years. That's the way I do it. So don't worry about the exact size of the battery. As long as it's got approximately the right ampere out and physically fits in there, go for it if it's got the tab. KC2MDP, K2LAW, that was an opinion.
Very good, Dick. Great minds think alike. That's a good story with the car battery. I do the exact same thing. As a matter of fact, I did put a battery in this HT. I soldered it in there, you know, we'll see how long it lasts, and I did go with the biggest battery I could actually fit in that thing before I started crushing little electronic components in there. Back to you.
Okay, was there somebody who wanted to make a comment on all of the above so far?
Okay, E2EJ.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, just a little warning about lithium ion batteries. If it's not exactly the same size, and you're using the control circuitry that deals with the charge rate and the discharge rate, you can run into trouble.
Yeah, but this is the battery that's not running the handy talkie. This is the battery for the memory backup. All that I understand is required is that if it's a 3-volt lithium, and if you have approximately 3 volts of keep alive on that integrated circuit when you turn off the handy, then you're not going to lose all your valuable frequencies that you programmed in and modes that you programmed in. So I don't think any real charging or discharging of the lithium holding battery is taking place. Am I wrong on that, Eric? Go ahead.
No, you're talking about a lithium flat cell. I talk about lithium ion as the main power source that has about 10 times the power density of those little damn things. But sorry I missed that. Okay, but I just wanted to say about lithium ion, which, you know, people have... buying, they're using them now in place of nickel metal hydride and nickel cadmium. Nickel cadmium, you don't really have to care too much about. Nickel metal hydride, you have to care a little more about. Lithium ion, you have to care a heck of a lot about.
Yeah, I work for a company that uses lithium polymer batteries like they're going out of style. And in the very beginning, 20-some-odd years ago, they had a number of explosions on these rechargeable batteries. To solve that problem, every single battery they put into every product, every lithium polymer battery, has a built-in protection circuit that will not allow you to overcharge, undercharge, will not allow you to over-discharge, and whatever. And once they've got a really rugged protection circuit in each individual battery pack, they've never had any trouble after that, so to speak. Now, my impression is lithium ion has got a lot more energy density. And if we had the money for it, I would much rather have lithium-ion batteries in my cell phone, my handy-talkie, anything that's got a battery. That's the good news. To properly charge a lithium-ion battery is a bit of a problem. I happen to be in love with this old-fashioned IC218 handy-talkie. And if I bought a lithium-ion battery that plugs into it, and I want to drop it into my normal plug-in charger, I cannot do that. Because I guarantee the regimen by which you properly charge one of those is an entirely different charging current voltage profile, is my belief. Do you happen to know of a solution to that? So I got two questions for you, Eric. Number one, how much more life will I get out of an exotic battery if I'm willing to pay for it? And number two, is there a solution to coming up with a good charger for that combination of my new battery on my old favorite handy-talkie? Back to you, Eric.
Roger, there actually are several solutions. Depending upon how you want to approach it, as you must know, the new Fight DAC, the new handy talkies come with lithium ion, and they have the correct circuit inside the battery case. And you also need the proper kind of charging stand for it. But they do make, Yaesu makes one that has different cups for different types of batteries, and it essentially provides the correct voltage for the type of battery that you're charging if you stick with the manufacturer's setup. If you want to go buy something that I'm not really aware of anybody that is making, say, a Yaesu battery that normally comes as NiCad and sticking lithium ion in it. I'm not aware of that. If you want to do that yourself, just have to know the size of the battery you're getting. You can actually buy little circuit boards with the charging circuit already on it and the discharge circuit, because don't forget, with lithium ion, it's both ways. You have to regulate the charge, you also have to regulate the discharge. You can actually do that. I think there's been there was a QEX article not too long ago that demonstrates that little process. And I think in QST there is also an article on charging lithium ion batteries, and you can get the information that you need for that. Go ahead, Dick.
Dick, Battery Tech in Hempstead has replacement lithium ion batteries and chargers for just about every radio.
Fantastic, Rich. What roughly is the delta in charge? If my old NiCad battery would have charged me $35 to replace it, what's your guess as to a equal physical size, much longer electrical life lithium polymer? Are we talking about more than twice the number of dollars?
About $70.
Beautiful, Howie. Is that approximately the price you saw also, Rich?
That varies. It depends how many milliamp or amp hours you want. But Howie's in the ballpark. And you get a matching charger. You tell him, you can go on the internet. We'll call them up. Or they got a couple of names, Battery Tech, and forget the other name for them. But call them up and tell them what radio you got. We'll sell you a battery and a matching charger with a replacement cup for that type of battery. By the way, Dick, put me down at the end for a quick question. And 2EO.
Well, forget me, I have a question also.
Yep, you're after Paul. Okay, the next person on the list was Paul, Whiskey 2, November. What's the latest with, I know you had a comment, but after that comment, start talking a little bit about the current space shuttle mission, which I think has a $25 million paid visitor. Whiskey 2, November, K2RIW, you got a poll.
Okay, good evening. The visitor's up there. Yeah, he went up on a Russian space station, Russian space craft to the International Space Station. He's the guy, he's the CEO for PayPal, and he's got his $25 million paid for to the Russians for a 10-day flight. My comment was, I mentioned the show Mythbusters last week. I wonder if anybody saw it. I did, and it was very good because it involved the topic some 10 or 15 years ago that was actually on one of your tech nets. I think it was on the Lockfield net at the time, Dick. And it dealt with the birds flying in the truck, and will the truck be lighter if the birds are flying around inside the truck. I wonder if you saw it, Dick, and or if anybody else did. Back to you, Dick.
It turns out that K2ZIW, Chris told me about this, saw it, gave me a full report, and as my understanding of what Chris saw was that they put four strain gauges, very accurate pressure measuring devices, in the four corners of a trailer, of the tractor-trailer truck, and put something like pigeons inside and had them do various flight profiles and try to make very careful measurements. They knew the weight of the pigeons, they knew the weight of the truck, they knew what the difference would be with theory A and theory B of flight. I mean, the people who go to Embry-Riddle or any other flight training school are taught the principle of Bernoulli's principle, that the air must move faster over the top of the wing because it's got a longer trip to go, and therefore it runs at a lower pressure, and there's a higher pressure at the bottom, and therefore you develop lift of the wing. Beautiful sounding story. I'm convinced it's almost dead wrong. Without a doubt, there is a lower pressure on top and a higher pressure on the bottom of the wing. The real question is that a cause or an effect? I say it's effect. In other words, the process of developing lift creates the difference in pressure. And what's the process of creating lift? It's called the wedge effect. The wing is operating at a angle of attack. It is deflecting air downward. Air is a massive fluid. You can have a lot of fun with your physics-minded friends and engineering friends. You take any human being you own, you know, other than a good aerodynamicist or other than a guy who has done cooling calculations with air-cooled equipment. Other than those two people, you tell them, please tell me what is the weight, you really mean mass, but call it weight. What is the weight of a cubic meter of air? The stuff that's in the room right now, a cubic meter of it, what does it weigh? And the first question somebody's going to have is, how the hell do you weigh that? And the answer is, I take a very strong steel box that's 1 cubic meter in volume, I put it on a scale. I then connect the vacuum pump, remove all the air, and I weigh it again. What will the difference be? You'll be amazed at the answers you get. I've done that experiment at least 50 times. The average engineer guesses 1 milligram is the weight of the air. A few of them will guess 10 grams. Some of them guess considerably less than a milligram. The answer is 2.7 pounds, more than a kilogram. Air is massive fluid. You've got a life experience that tells you that. When you were 5 years old, 10 years old, and you stuck your hand out of the car at 60 miles an hour, something darn heavy was hitting that hand. You felt a lot of pressure. A guy named Timothy McVeigh built a bomb, exploded it in front of the Mura building in Oklahoma City, and crushed a building with nothing but a shock wave in air. Essentially, none of that bomb struck that building. Only the shock wave in air did it and killed 150 some odd people. So air is heavy stuff. So when the wind deflects the air, Newton's third law, action-reaction, tells you you're going to get an opposite effect called lift. And you can measure the fact that, and by the way, they did it also with a helicopter. And that was done on Newton's apple. You fly a helicopter over a dining room table that's got a careful weighing balance on it. And you'll discover that even when the helicopter hovers a foot above the table will sense the exact same weight as when the helicopter is sitting on the table and not running. Helicopters, airplanes, they deflect air downward. That's where the lift is coming from. That's where 99% of the lift is coming from. You say that to a typical pilot, and you'll get nothing but flack. Because they have heard this story for so many years, it is so ingrained, it became the truth, whether it is or not. And I can direct you to a website where the Langley Research Center did an experiment on this, and the results are striking. And so there's a lot more to that story, as you can tell. I thought, and I'm not sure, that I invented the puzzle of the birds in the truck way back 20 or so years ago, and I put it on the TechNet for the Lockfield, and I think I put it on this TechNet also. I thought I invented it because I had never heard of it before then. But who knows? It may have been a co-inventor, and maybe by the time the story went around the world a few times, it's rather obscure as to who invented it. Thank you for bringing it to my attention, and I'm awful glad that the Mythbusters used that. And it does teach something. One of the stories was that Lindbergh, Charles Lindbergh, when he was flying across the Atlantic, had a housefly in the cockpit with him, and he was doing a calculation as to whether or not he was burning more gas when the housefly is in flight versus when the housefly is sitting on the steering wheel. I don't believe the story. It's a very nice-sounding story. I have sat in the full-size mock-up of his cockpit at the Cradle of Aviation Museum. And I know damn well the wind was whistling through that cockpit like you wouldn't believe, and no way in hell could there be a housefly that stayed there. So I know it's a story. But it's a good-sounding story. WS2M, back to you, Paul. KQRIW in the Tech Man.
Got a question, Dick. KQTY.
Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, okay, you want to pick up Mel?
Yeah, go ahead, Mel, first, and then you pass it directly over to Paul.
Okay, they have a classic picture, one of them, I think, encyclopedia, I remember the one looking at. It was done many, many years ago, maybe 200 years ago. You may have seen it, where they took two half spheres and they put them together, and then they vacuum, removed the air, he pumped the air out. I can't think of the wood scientist did that experiment back in, I guess it was the 17th or 18th century. And then they had horses pulling on each end of the sphere, each sphere on each side, and they couldn't pull them apart. Do you know which one I'm talking, the experiment that was, Dick, over?
Absolutely. I think it was Archimedes, but I'm not sure. It almost doesn't matter. But yes, once you pull a vacuum on those two spheres, if they got a reasonable amount of volume, it's really cross-sectional area across that that interfacing surface. At 14.7 pounds per square inch, you can build up pressure real fast. And by the way, whether you have horses pulling on both sides, you got three horses to the left and three horses to the right, or if you connect it to a wall and you have three horses to the right, the answer is the same. Same amount of force. Just that it looks more dramatic with six horses. If six horses can't pull it apart, well, it turns out the three horses can produce the exact same amount of force if it's connected to a wall. So air pressure is what you're discussing, which is also very significant. But when it comes to flight of a wing, it is air mass that we're talking about, not pressure. Quite a difference. And so, by the way, when your automobile is at dockside or near any body of water, lake, pond, river, whatever, if there's the slightest possibility your automobile is going to go in the water, if you want to stay alive, your very first reaction will be open the windows. If they're electrically operated, start moving the windows down immediately. Common sense would lead you to believe, I want to close the windows and keep the water out. Uh-uh. I don't care if that vehicle only goes 1 foot underwater. The pressure of the water on that great big area of the door is such that Arnold Schwarzenegger will not be able to open that door. If you don't crawl out through the window, you're going to stay in that vehicle and drown. And there's tens of people in the United States that die in that scenario every year. So whenever a vehicle you're in starts approaching water for any reason, be darn sure the windows are open. It is your only method of escape. Okay, Paul, you got it. WS2M, K2RIW on the TechNet.
KQRQ.
Hey, Dick, very good. The Mythbusters show did have a guy on to talk about the science behind it. I was so glad he did, because I mentioned it last week, and he brought up the a reaction has an equal and opposite reaction theory from Newton, talking about the air being deflected down, and if that's going down, the wing is going up. So, yeah, they confirmed that as well, which I thought was very important. They did bring up the theory of flight, which was good. And they did use a helicopter. Well, they used two helicopters. The first one crashed into the wall because there's a lot of turbulence inside the truck. The second one they were successful with. And, yeah, they used, it looked like they had some kind of, crystals mounted in a box that were attached to a beam and four locations. So as the beam would be stressed from weight, any kind of weight, they have a voltage going, you know, through the crystal piezoelectric type effect, I guess. I don't know. And as the crystal would strain, it would send the voltage out, and they had all these four points tied into a computer, and they were able to zero it out before they started, and birds took off finally, and it showed no difference with the birds, and no difference with the helicopters. So it worked out really good. Great, great show. And, I figured you started it, Dick. No, there was a series of questions you had back in those days. I remember the one with the balloons in a car, which way are they going to go when you make a left turn, right turn, one after the other. And those were good puzzles that you had. Wonderful. And I was glad to see that they said this was one of the most popular questions that people wanted to be answered in the, they have a website, Mythbuster website, so they finally did this one. And, yeah, they did the under the water car one as well one time, where Adam sinks into the car and he's got to get out, and windows open, windows closed, he waits until you get to the bottom, you know. All of that, they did go through all of that. If you think about the International Space Station, they have to equalize the pressure on the doors when they dock. If they're off, even by, one time they were off by half a pound, you know, they have to be 10.5, I think, is the pressure that they use in the space station, as opposed to 14.7 here on Earth. But they were off by half, and there was no way that they could open up this, you know, 1 meter round door. It's just impossible. You know, you think about half a pound of, you know, on all those square inches on a meter diameter door. There's no way you could open that. And they had to wait until they had it properly equalized before they could do it. So, yeah, that all comes into play, Dick. And, yeah, good show. They went through everything pretty much that we talked about on the net, and they did it with the big truck. Finally, they started off with one bird, you know, how they worked their way up. Eventually, they get to a big truck with a whole bunch of birds flying around, so it was pretty good. Space topic, I'll continue later if you want. Not much on it, but just one or two items. Back to you, Dick. WS2M.
Very fine, Paul. Lou, I think you wanted to make a comment. Go ahead.
I have two brief comments. One is that passenger on the space station came down yesterday with the other two crew members that were released. And yesterday or the day before, actually. And I don't believe Archimedes could have actually done that experiment with the hemispheres, but I know it as the Magdeburg hemispheres, and we used to demonstrate that in general science.
Okay, Magdeburg. Sounds good. And at 14.7 pounds per square inch, it doesn't require very many inches of diameter of the sphere to develop some really fierce forces. And a tiny amount of water, a foot or two of depth of water coming up above the lower edge of your car door, will give you an amount of pressure that you will not be able to open that car door, even if you're Arnold Schwarzenegger, as I said before. So an amazing number of people, tens of people in the United States, die from that scenario every year, and it's a useless death because It's just a matter of not understanding the physics ahead of time. It's one of these situations you have to start studying it ahead of time. Even though it's rare, you have to know what to do. Very similar to studying CPR. I mean, lots of people are alive because of the Heimlich maneuver or because of CPR being studied. And so a person was prepared when the incident occurred and lives were saved. So you have to know. Let's see now. Howie, I think you wanted to have had a comment or a question. W2HWW, K2RIW in the second half.
Dick?
Yeah, I have a question. I think Richie's out there. I'll let Richie go first, Dick, then take me.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, thank you, Howie. Just a quick comment. I think one of the reasons, as I recall, why Ed White, William Chafee, and Gus Grissom died in that fire on the Liberty One, was it? Because the hatch opened from the inside and pressure built up. Is that correct, Dick? I believe after that accident, they made the hatch open from the outside.
Yeah, Chafee, White, and Grissom, Apollo 1, a practice maneuver on the launch pad, but they were running with pure oxygen. And in those days, not only did the hatch open inward, but the hatch had to be unbolted from the inside. They had to remove these bolts and nuts in order to release the hatch, in order to move it inward, in order to open it. An extremely long procedure. And after that, they made the hatch move outward and to disconnect itself with explosive bolts. Huge difference. And so the best thinking was that on Apollo 1, one of the socket wrenches were left under the bench. The socket wrench created a short circuit in the wiring with the pressure of the astronaut on it, and a short circuit of the wiring, and the wiring was flammable material in a pure oxygen environment. And it started burning violently, creating an internal overpressure, and even if the bolts were off the door, they would not have been able to open it, the hatch. But multiple errors took place in that whole scenario. Three or four errors came together. In other words, the people doing the work on a space capsule really must count the tools they had going in and the tools coming back out. And that count better be the same, or they'll stop the action until you find the missing tool. Very similar to what happens in a good operation. When your thoracic surgeon opens up your stomach and he's doing an operation on your intestine, somebody in the room is supposed to count all the tools and sponges and everything else. And what comes back out better be the same number that went into that room. Because to seal up a patient and leave a forceps inside, and it's been done, is a pretty embarrassing situation. And under the heat of battle with a difficult operation, if an accident can very easily happen, a tool can easily get tucked behind one of the organs of the body, which is easily moved around during the operation. Okay, Howie, on a more pleasant note, give us a more pleasant subject here, Howie. WB2HWW, K2RIW in the second half.
Hi, Dick, K2RIW. Dick, I have a issue with Intermod on 10 meters. I'm going to give you a bunch of frequencies and explain to you what's happening. You copy me okay?
Good copy. Please proceed.
All right. You have a 10-meter repeater, split site. You have a receiver that's receiving 29,560. You have a situation when you have another transmitter somewhere else come up on 29,680, and your repeater is transmitting on 29,660. If everything is okay, if there's nobody transmitting on, say, 680, there's no strong signal on 680, you have your repeater operating on 29,560 and 29,660, and somebody keys up, say, on 29,580 or 540, you have no problem. They don't bother your receiver. You with me so far, Dick?
I sure am. I'm amazed at only 100 kc of separation on 10 meters, so go ahead.
Well, that's what the FCC allows. That's the way it's set up. That's why you're on split site. Now, if a station comes up on 29,680, suddenly another repeater comes up on 29,680. Not their fault. It comes up, and then somebody starts transmitting on 580 or 540 or 520, it will bother the receiver. The receiver will start getting intermod. If either the 680 transmitter or the 660 transmitter goes down, you won't have that situation. But you got to have 660 up because that's part of the repeater, 560 and 660. But if a strong signal comes up on 680, any kind of a signal, either on 580 or 540 or 520, will cause an intermod problem. You'll hear feedback. You'll hear it mixing with the 680, with the 660 transmitter. It will come in. I'm wondering if I were to use a crystal filter, a very tight crystal filter, that would give me at least 30 dBs of isolation or attenuation at 100 kc. Will that solve it? And you think it's you think it's just overload where the input stage is just going into compression?
Yeah, I've done a quick calculation of your thirds and fifth order intermods, and at first it appears as though the frequencies miss each other. The intermods of those frequency combinations with transmitters should not be creating a signal on the receiver frequency. But maybe it's not the third or the fifth, maybe it's the seventh. However, any receiver that is receiving more than one frequency, and if any one of the frequencies it receives from DC to light is strong enough to shove the amplification stage into limiting. And when I say limiting, I'm not talking about 1 dB of compression. I'm not talking about 0.1 dB of compression. I'm talking about 0.01 dB of compression. The slightest amount of compression created by a strong signal will convert that amplifier into a mixer. Once it becomes a mixer, it takes all possible harmonics of all frequencies present and creates all possible combinations. It's called the M by N problem. M for Mary, N for Nancy. And you plug in integers for M and N. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So it may be the third harmonic of M and the fourth harmonic of N, Mike and November, that happens to be an intermod that falls into your particular frequency range. So anything that you can do to stop this extremely minor amount of limiting. Filtering, higher intercept mixers. I've seen people in situations like this after doing a very hard study of what's the first stage that goes into limiting of their receiver system, and they discovered that, gee, the second amplifier downrange after 20 dB of gain is the one that's going into limiting first, and I can't filter out that signal. I can't create enough filtering without creating a lot of insertion loss and raised noise figure. I have seen people take a transmitting grade transistor and plug it into a receiver front end and bias it appropriately so that it becomes a brick you know what, and that nothing in the world can create limiting at any reasonable power level. I've seen people do that. And when you do that, quite often if you choose the right transmitting grade transistor, instead of it having 3/10 of a dB noise figure, it might have 7/10 of a dB noise figure. But it may have an intercept point that's 15 decibels higher, and it cures the problem. I've seen people do that. So with some careful laboratory measurement, you could slowly put in stronger and stronger signals as a two-tone, and with a good spectrum analyzer sampling after the first preamplifier, after the second preamplifier, after the mixer, into the first IF, and so on. By doing a good sampling function, in other words, you're connecting either with a 1 picofarad capacitor or a 1 megohm resistor, so you're not really loading down the circuit, but you're sniffing enough signal to be far enough above threshold on the spectrum analyzer that you can see what is the spectrum looking like at that particular stage of the receiver. You plug in two tones and you slowly raise the amplitude of the two tones, and you do the sample at each one of the stages downrange in the receiver and find out who makes the strongest intermod first. And once you find that out, you'll say, uh-huh, that's the stage that's going in limiting first. It may not be the first stage. In some cases, on one particular system I studied, the military system, the first stage that went into limiting was the fourth amplification stage downrange. And that limiting was creating a lot of grief. And everyone thought that whenever you get limiting an intermod, it's always the front end. Not always. And certain exotic receivers, it could be the fourth stage downrange. And so we had to make improvements in the intercept point of that fourth stage. I mean, physically, that particular aircraft, it was after 75 feet of cable, a whole great big preamplifier box, a mixer box, a down converter box, and then we went into the stage that was creating limiting that had to have a higher intercept point. And it made a significant improvement in the overall performance when we did that. So you have, by way of your IFR, which is a kind of a spectrum analyzer, has a spectrum analyzer function, or you can borrow one, you could perform this test. I didn't say it's easy, but there are ways you can measure it, And the filter you describe, it's worth a try. I give you a 50-50 chance. When you really dig in and study one of these situations, half the time it's a lot more complicated than first meets the eye. Intimates are not simple. They definitely separate the men from the boys when you're in a high-dense environment of New York City, Howie, as you know. WB2HWW, K2RW on the TechNet.
N2MMS.
Got N2MMS, I'll let them in here. Dick, but wait a minute, let me ask you a question. Don't you have limiting in an FM receiver? Isn't the idea of FM receivers that you have a stage downline that acts as a limiter? So isn't one of the stages going into limiting, Dick?
Absolutely. You have a limiter right in front of the discriminator. But by the time you get that far downrange, you're supposed to be at 10 or 15 kilohertz of noise equivalent bandwidth with a brick wall filter. That IF strip with all of its stages in front of it, with all of the filtering at each of those stages, is such that if the receiver is being used in the right way, and if the receiver is performing correctly, there is absolutely positively nothing but one single signal going into that limiter. Under that condition, the limiter can do beautiful things for you. If by any means there's more than one signal that arrives at that limiter, you're in a heap of trouble. N2MNS. Go right ahead, sir. Is that Mike November Sierra, K2RAW on TechNet? Start off with your name, sir.
Your name is John on this end. John, and the call is Nancy 2, Mike Sierra. I just got to work out here. I just turned the HP on. I was going around the bend. I heard this coming in really good. I never heard nobody on this frequency before. I'm out here in Toms River, New Jersey on HP waiting to get on a bus out here. And I was just kind of wondering, where was this repeater coming out of there? I'm sorry to interrupt your, I don't know what you got going on out there. I just keyed up real quick there. I just appreciate if you let me know where the repeater is.
Okay, John, I think you live in Denville. This repeater is at what we call Glen Oaks, which is right on the border between Nassau County and Queens County on Long Island. I guess we're about 15 or so miles east of New York City. That's where this repeater is located. And you're listening to the 1,134th session of the technical net that has met on this particular frequency most of the last 20 years. 8 o'clock we start, and you're hearing something that's been around for a long time, but I guess you're in a part of the world where the signal doesn't normally get there. This particular repeater does intentionally steer a null in its antenna pattern toward Frenchtown, because Frenchtown is on the exact same frequency, I believe. Okay, I guess it was Howie. I don't think you had a chance to finish your comment. WB2HWW, go ahead, Howie. KQLAW.
We definitely have a band over here. I'm going to get off and go down on this. Go down in 2 meters and see what it can work. Dick, yes, but here's the situation. You have the limiter, but the stage, what I said was, when that other signal comes up on 680, like something is 20 kilohertz away, like 580, 540, which is 20 kilohertz away. When something comes up on either frequency, either side of the channel that I'm receiving, that's where I get the mix. So I guess that's what that's...
Yeah, I think you passed it over to me, Howie. Without a doubt, if the separation is 5, 10, 20, 25, 40, correction, 50, any combination where you multiply the difference by some higher harmonic and it comes out with 100 kc of separation, which is between your normal transmitter and receiver, you will be getting an intimod. But those separations can only create that intimod if there is a nonlinearity. If the system was thoroughly linear, if there was no passive intermodulation distortion, in other words, no rusty bolts nearby, no lousy corroding contacts in the antenna feed line and the antenna itself, and if all the stages of the receiver were operating in a thoroughly linear manner, under those conditions, there would be no intimod. You have to have a nonlinearity in either amplitude or phase in order to create intimod. Usually it's amplitude. So with a two-tone study and very gentle sampling of the various stages of your receiver system, everything from the front-end connector all the way down to near the last IF stage, with a good two-tone test, you can easily measure a instructed guy can easily measure what is the intercept point at each one of those stages. In other words, how strong must the two tones be so that the intermod is X number of dB down. The easiest way to do it would be to adjust the amplitude of the two tones until the intermod is 20 dB down from the two tones, and write down what power level at the antenna port does that after the first stage. What power level at the antenna port does that at the second stage. What power level of the two tones at the antenna port does that at the third stage. So with that kind of a measurement procedure, when you keep coming back to exactly 20 decibels of intermod performance of a two-tone test, where the two tones are very close together, so you know that they're getting through all of those stages of amplification, with that kind of a test, with a good spectrum analyzer and a smart guy, you will be measuring the antenna-related intercept point at each one of those stages. You will rapidly find out which link of the chain is the weakest link, and then you can decide to beef up that stage. Raise its intercept point by increasing its bias. Raise its intercept point by using a transmitting transistor instead of a low-noise receiver transistor in that location. Put in a better roofing filter. Put in a better brick wall filter, and whatever. There's a zillion ways of doing it, but by measurement, you can find out which link in the chain is the weakest one. This is on the assumption it's taking place in the receiver itself, and it is my guess that 90% probability is taking place in the receiver itself. Yeah, there is the possibility of passive intermods. There is the possibility of other things that are co-located in your location, another transmitter that's aggravating the problem. Another way that this kind of a problem comes up is that some particular technician is sent to a two-way repeater site, and he is told to adjust the transmitter until you get 30 watts of output. And he's sitting at 28 watts. And he tweaks and tweaks and tweaks, and he can't get more than 28 watts. If he had half a brain, he'd walk away. And he'd write down 30 watts if that's what they absolutely positively got to have. But he does some fiddling, and he discovers that if he removes the circulator, the 28 watts goes up to 30.5. He says, aha, that's a solution. And he walks away. And if he removes the circulator on the output of that transmitter, he has just become a hazard to every other chunk of electronics that's at that location. Because now the final stage of his transmitter is capable of mixing everything that's on that site together in all possible combinations. Until you find that guy that's got the missing circulator, everybody's going to go crazy for the next month or two until you pin him down. And the only way you can stop that from happening is to either have very well-educated people that don't pull that trip, or to take that damn circulator and lock it down in such a way that nobody can remove it, weld it in place. You take away that circulator, and boy, you're going to create havoc. WB2HWW, K2RIW in the TechNav.
All right, Dick, but what do you think of these piezoelectric filters? They're claiming I can get like 35 to 40 dB down at 100 kilohertz. I figured, let me try that. To go and start measuring, it's just too much involved. So I'm thinking about just spending $300 and trying it. A two-pole filter at 100 kcs, it'll give you about 40 dB down. You know, anything farther out than that, it levels up at about 45. It can handle up to about 3 dBs of in-band signal before it'll blow up, 3 dBs. And it has like 2.5 dBs to 3 dBs of loss. I figure at 10 meters, you know what? It won't affect my performance, the sensitivity. Because the receiver's got about 0.15 microvolts in sensitivity into a service monitor. I think I can pull away at least another 0.15, even 0.2, even 0.4 microvolts on that frequency. Wouldn't it be a problem? All right. Thank you very much. Just curious, what do you think of just trying it? You think I got a half of a chance of stopping the problem with a good, sharp crystal filter in the front end?
I give you a 50-50 chance, Howie, not much more than that. Because the crystal in the front end is going to create a little bit of insertion loss, a little bit of raise of noise figure. That's minor. The crystal needs protection. If the crystal is the front end object, a lightning strike, I think, can take it out. And a crystal is a beautiful thing. A piezoelectric crystal is a beautiful thing up to the amplitude that it becomes nonlinear. The crystal itself, at some particular amplitude level, will generate intermod. you'll be blazing a brand new trail if you put a crystal filter between the antenna and the beginning of your receiver. I think very few people have done that. I think there's very little history. It's worth a try. I only give you a 50-50 chance. But don't give up. If you're convinced that it's worth a try, go for it. If you're a man who's got the resources and it's not going to break the bank, it's worth a try. But I'm a bit worried, as you can tell. Back to you, Harry.
All right, but the manufacturer said that this is the application. They say this is used to get rid of stuff. They say that the crystal will only oscillate. The only problem you got to worry about is in-band frequency. They say it's +3 to +4 dB. I asked the manufacturer, you know, he could be telling me some BS. He said this two-pole filter, as long as you don't have a direct lightning hit and you have a quarter wave stub or something across the thing to give you some DC protection, he said you shouldn't have any real problem. He said this is the application when you want a razor sharp front end, but I guess you're the kind of guy that believes in mechanical filters or cavities instead of going the crystal way. Am I correct in your feeling?
Yeah, cavity is a front end I would trust. The crystal is a front end. Maybe this guy has built something that's really rugged, intended for that service, and maybe he's got a brand new solution, and down at 29 megs you can do that. I'm almost positive you cannot do that at 2 meters. So at 29 megs where you can almost run a pretty robust, I don't think you can make it with first, but I think you can make it with a third order crystal resonator. It's worth a try. And he did say he's intending it for that service. Okay. Let us know. Keep us informed as you run that experiment, Howard. Sounds like a beauty. Let's see now. Did I skip anybody who signed in up till now? If so, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW.
M2EO.
M2MB with another question.
And K2J with something weird.
That filter comes with N connectors or SO239. It's made for military applications.
Sounds like he's got the right words. It's a brand new application. Let me skip over everybody for a second. Eric, what have you got that's weird?
You're going to like this one, Dick. Okay, it's about colony collapse disorder. Bear with me, I have a really bad cold. Okay, you'll like this. Colony collapse disorder occurs when a beehive, we're talking about bees now, when a hive's inhabitants suddenly disappear, leaving only queens, eggs, and a few immature workers. All right? And it has been said, actually Einstein said, when the bee disappears, humans have about four years to live. Right? Now, there's a couple of studies that are ongoing that have shown that bees are disappearing from the world's population. And one of the things that they did is that the theory is that radiation from mobile phones, cell sites, interferes with the bee's navigation system, preventing the famously home-loving species from finding their way back to their hive. And as improbable as it may seem, there is no evidence to back this up. What do you think, Dick?
Yeah, I've heard that, and I'm a bit worried. By worried, I mean, I think it's a pretty hokey story. Yeah, if the bees always fly within, let me pick a number, 30 feet of a cell site, I see the possibility that it could be interfered with. But I can't believe that bees do that. Almost all cell sites have the antenna something in the vicinity of 100, 120 feet in the air. I think on rare occasions do bees fly that high. But it can't get close enough to the signal. By the inverse square law, they're not getting much. You got to be careful with statistics. Just because the total number of cell sites in the United States right now might be something like 150,000 cell sites. And so you can look at the rate of increase in cell sites, you can look at the rate of decrease in the available bees to do the pollinating, and you can say, yeah, I see a correlation. Well, are you sure? Because there's a hell of a lot of other things that are going on at the same time. We're getting global warming, we're using some pretty exotic chemistry for pest control and for fertilizing our fields. All kinds of things are going on at once. The total number of arable spaces being used for farming is continuously decreasing. We're paving everything over with
with macadam and asphalt, building houses all over the place, taking away farmland, taking away the natural sources of the pollen that the bees use. So a darn many things are happening at once. Can you really say that this is the one causative agent and all the others don't matter, and it's cell phone base stations? Boy, I give you about a 1% chance that that's what it is. What do you think, Eric? K2EJ, K2IW, the TechNet.
Well, interestingly enough, the Germans have shown bees behave to change near power lines, the magnetic influence. There's been studies that show that there's the influence of a lot of pesticides, global warming, and so on and so forth. But one study is interesting, is that they would take a hive and just put a cell phone. Now, you know, a cell phone is constantly transmitting. Most people don't realize it. But when they place the cell phone near a hive, bees don't come back. So it's not to say that we're talking about square law here, because if you look at things like whales and other mammals that, you know, have this intricate navigation that we're not really quite sure how it works, whether it's magnetic, sonar, or, you know, the various different interesting things that nature provides, that it's food for thought. And I'm not saying that it is or it ain't, but it's just an interesting story.
And one last question to Eric. Was it an authoritative journal that reported this so-called correlation? I mean, if I read that in the National Enquirer, I'm not going to give it quite as much emphasis as if I read it in Science Magazine, the AAAS journal. Back to you, Eric. Where did you read it?
In a couple of places. One of the universities is Landau University in the UK. I happen to do a lot of reading of The Independent, which is a British paper. It's under the environment and wildlife category. And it gives you a bunch of searchable, traceable sources. So it's not like it's the National Enquirer I'm looking at.
Okay, one crazy question for you, Eric. If we do absolutely positively confirm that both the cell phones, the client cell phones, as well as the cell phone base stations, are aggravating these poor bees, and if we confirm that, what's your guess as to what a possible solution would be?
Well, that's an interesting question. Well, is it cell phones? Is it 900 megahertz? Is it 1200 megahertz? Is it frequency selective? Is it energy selective? Nobody's answered those kinds of questions. When you get answers to that, let's say it just so happens that their navigation system is whatever method it is. I suspect it's geomagnetic more than anything else, because that's what it seems to be for lots of things in nature. If we, let's say, were to find out that the PCS phones, like in Europe, they use GSM, and this is where they're noticing it. They tend not to use the 900, they use the 1.2 and the 1.6. Well, if it's only in that frequency range, move it.
Yeah, the modulation could be a factor. Is it GSM? Is it PCS? Is it TDMA? And so on. Is it modulation? Is it the 1800 meg band, the 1900 meg band, the 2.2 gig band, the 800 meg band? Complicated problem. One more situation where if you think the problem is simple, you probably don't understand the problem. Nothing is simple when you really get down to the nitty-gritty. Rich, N2EO, I know you want to make a comment, so does Barry. We got a bunch of people. N2EO, go right ahead.
Okay, Dick, I had a question. Is this the time?
If it's not a super long one, fire away.
Okay, Dick. You know, the amplifier I'm working on, the filaments of those 8877s are supposed to be 5.0 volts, and according to the spec sheet from IMAC, they say plus or minus 0.25 volts. I'm wondering if they're being super critical. I'd measure it with a digital meter. I'm running 5.39 volts. I did order some rheostat to put in the primary to bring it down a little bit. I'm wondering if you think that's overkill. I've got a comment if there's time, Dick.
You don't really have to do a rheostat there, Rich. you know, by way of the data sheet, exactly how much current is being drawn at 5.39 volts. And by the way, worry a little bit about the accuracy of your digital voltmeter. Before I go and get real bothered by this, I would borrow Barry's DGM and make sure it also reads 5.39 plus or minus 0.01 or something like that. Try to get at least two different brand names, two different meters, both giving you the same voltage. Once you get that, you know exactly what current and what voltage is going into that filament. IMAC told you. You know you're putting 120 volts in the primary. Therefore, you know exactly what the current in the primary is. You would know exactly what percentage you want to drop that voltage. Therefore, you can calculate exactly what resistor will do it. And for all we know, a 5-foot length of 24-gauge wire is all the resistor that's required in the primary to do that. So it doesn't have to be a rheostat. A rheostat sounds nice, but they tend to develop scratchy contacts in a service like that. I'd much rather see you solder in something that puts you right in the middle of that range. And yes, there is some merit in trying to get within the voltage range that IMAC recommends. They're not being super conservative. There is a lot of exotic chemistry that goes on in the design of that cathode. And in order for the tube to have maximum life with maximum performance during that life, there's a very narrow range of voltage you want to be on the filament. The life of an incandescently heated filament is a function of the voltage you put on the filament to the 12th power. Let me repeat that. Life of an incandescent filament in the case of a light bulb. The life of the light bulb is a function of the voltage to the 12th power. You raise that voltage a little bit, and the life of the light bulb comes down real fast. I don't think the filament of a tube is quite that severe. In your case, it's not the filament wearing out. It is you wearing out the chemistry that's in the cathode. The cathode has got all kinds of chemistry, this thoriated stuff, which is a nuclear active material that's in the cathode material, and it's supposed to bubble to the surface at just the right rate in order to get the right performance of the cathode without excessively boiling off this valuable stuff that's in the cathode. So for that reason, there is a very narrow voltage range that runs the cathode at just the right temperature to keep the tube happy. So I would try to do that. And you, with Ohm's law, have the ability to calculate the resistor in the primary that'll do that. Back to you, Rich. KQLIW.
Is that AC or DC on the filament stick?
Of course it's AC. It's a transformer being fed with AC. Is that true, Rich?
Now that's correct, Dick. The reason I wanted to put a rheostat in, I've seen this done on homebrew amps, because we get voltage cutbacks in the summer. And I'm told that running it low is just as bad as running it high. So I want them to be able to keep it around 5 volts during the summer months.
I got a comment, Dick.
The filaments.
Yeah, go ahead, Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, on Collins, their amplifier, they have a 5-position switch on the filament pick over.
QED. So Collins, who built some really high-quality equipment, are trying to maintain it. Howie, you had a comment on this?
Can you run those filaments on DC and 5 volts DC?
AC, Howard.
Yeah, it's AC right now, and Howie is recommending that you consider the possibility of using a voltage regulator and running it on 5 volt DC. I don't recommend that. Boy, I don't recommend that. The current that goes into that cathode is fierce. To put in a regulator at that lower voltage, at that number of amperes, is a difficult design. I'd much rather see him build a servo mechanism which measures the voltage on the filament and does something in the primary of the transformer. If you really want to get exotic about this, you could put some kind of a minor switching regulator in the primary to keep the RMS voltage on the filament constant. That's an approach. But that's this is adding icing on the cake and gilding the lily after everything else in the amplifier is running hunky-dory. I know you're doing some experiments lately of changing the number of turns in the resonating coil of the Pi-L network and to try to make it work better. It sounds like you're making progress. I was amazed that when you increased the turns, the coil ran colder and you got more power output. Sounds like everything is good with one exception, and that is try to do some kind of a test with a IFR or spectrum analyzer to be sure that all the power you're measuring output, which is increasing, make sure it's all on the right frequency. Make sure it's not any harmonic power. If you're making a change to that coil, and the harmonics of a television are not getting terrible, and the, all of the power, 99% of it, is on your favorite frequency, then keep doing it. Back to you, Rich.
I got another comment, Dick.
Go ahead, Howard. I mean, Mel.